Hello and welcome to Trail Mix by Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast. I'm Dusty. If you're joining us for the first time, Trail Mix is the short format episodes of our show. While our long format episodes explore one hiking trail in one national park, one park at a time, Trail Mix allows us to dive deeper into the things we didn't get to cover in our long format episodes, including history, science, environmental justice, and interviews. If you've listened to some of our other interviews on the show, you'll hear from outdoor authors of national park guides and influential folks who helped to create a safer and more inclusive outdoors. And in the spirit of environmentalism and protecting conservation efforts, today's interview is the first of its kind for our show. Today, we are interviewing Alex Keloff, the Democrat running in Colorado's 3rd District, looking to flip the current seat in the U.S. House of Representatives that is currently held by a Republican incumbent. While this is our first interview with a political candidate seeking office, we deeply believe in preserving democracy, and we are happy to join in the efforts to flip as many seats in Congress as possible come this year's midterm elections. In the interest of transparency, Alex Keloff reached out to us directly to see if we could sit down for a conversation specifically to discuss his platform for environmental action and justice in Colorado's 3rd District, especially given the national park spaces within that district. At this time, he has raised considerable funds for his campaign without taking any corporate money, including from AIPAC, and we did this interview out of our own civic engagement and no money was exchanged. We sat down with Alex a few weeks ago and discussed the difference between coastal America and rural America, the current toll this administration is taking on the national parks, and his plan for Colorado's 3rd District. Here's that conversation. We are so excited today to be speaking to Alex Keloff. Alex, welcome to Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast. We're so happy to be able to chat with you today.
Thanks for having me, guys. Good to be here.
Yes.
Alex, can you tell us where, since we are a podcast that reaches many people across the country and also in little pockets across the world too, can you tell us where you're coming to us from and what you are running for specifically?
So I'm coming to you from the Roaring Fork Valley in Colorado, specifically Aspen, Colorado, and I am running for the U.S. House of Representatives, so Congress, in this coming election, the midterm election, November 3rd. This is Colorado's 3rd congressional district, of which makes up, it's one of the largest congressional districts in the country, 53,000 square miles, 27 counties. It's all of Western Colorado and almost all of Southern Colorado.
Which, as we know from our travels and our show, do you have 2 national parks in the 3rd district? You've got a lot of sites.
The Black Canyon of the Gunnison Monument. I have a big map here on next to my wall. Dinosaur. There are a number of obviously points of interest in this district.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Can you give us a little bit about your general background? And then I'd love to hear a little bit more about you and your time in the outdoors and how that has shaped you throughout your life.
So this is the first time I've ever run for public office. I've never been involved in politics before. I'm 52 years old, going on 53 in the next 2 months. And my whole career has been in business for the last 30 plus years. And we can get more into that. But the family history in this specific congressional district goes back over 130 years. My great-grandfather on my father's side immigrated to Trinidad, Colorado, which is in the southeast portion of the state, in 1893. He came over with his 3 brothers. And like many immigrants at the time, they came actually to dig coal because that's where the good jobs were at the time. Subsequently, my grandfather was born in the district. He dug coal before going on to become a small business person. He started grocery stores. So it was called Keloff's Food Markets throughout Southern Colorado. And those were operated by my grandfather. And then my uncle took over. Those ran for 70 years. My mother grew grew up in Grand Junction. She went to high school there, and that's the largest city in this district. My grandparents, my grandfather also was a small business owner. He worked as a carpenter, tile layer. I know we're going to talk about the outdoors a lot. Cool fact, he worked on helping to build the first house in Vail, Colorado in 1962. So he and my grandmother said, oh, these mountain towns are going to be good for his business. And they moved to the Roaring Fork Valley in the 60s. That's where Aspen is and other Carbondale basalt. They then lived in the Roaring Fork Valley in the 60s, 70s, and 80s before retiring back in Grand Junction. So I actually grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. My father's been a lifelong public servant as a cancer researcher at the National Cancer Institute. So his job was physically in Bethesda, Maryland, which is why I grew up in Virginia. But every holiday break, we were back in Colorado's 3rd District because that's where all of the family lived. And I learned to ski in the 70s in the Aspen area and have always had a love of the outdoors from that experience growing up.
The amazing, the deep roots that you have within Colorado. And it's amazing, too, to see that your dad has been a lifelong public servant. Did that influence your move into like public service? Was that like a big push for you?
It absolutely did. I mean, I feel like I had success in business and I'd made that career, as I said, over the last 30 plus years. But I was always taught do well so that you can do good. And I think this is my time to do good for what I can do, particularly in this district, in the state of Colorado, and hopefully our country. And so after the 2024 presidential election, when Donald Trump was reelected, I was seriously concerned about the direction he would take this country. And here we are, you know, almost 13 years after him taking office, State of the Union last night. This is far worse than I actually could have imagined. So I knew when he was reelected that I needed to get involved and serve the people, do what I could. And I decided, given my family history in this district, that I would run. And so in April of last year, April 2025, I announced my candidacy. And I've been on the campaign trail now for 10 months. I continue to run unopposed in this district as the sole Democrat running and hope to flip this seat from the incumbent Republican come November 3rd.
Well, that is what we want to, because we want to flip as many seats as we can. Here's my question for you, just right off the bat. What are some things that are happening in your district that are pissing you off that you're ready to change?
The first and foremost one is, look, we need to uphold the rule of law, right? And so it's equally applicable anywhere across this country as it is this district. But upholding the rule of law, ensuring that Congress gets back to fulfilling its constitutional obligation as a co-equal branch of government. The Constitution had Article 1 assigned to Congress, the premier branch of government. So that's, you know, that as I crisscross this huge district. And I'll note, by the way, as we're also talking about parks and the outdoors, I made it a goal of mine to reach all 27 counties before the end of last year, and I did that. So I haven't quite kept tally. I need to add up how many miles we've driven, but it's now well over, you know, it's in the tens of thousands, I think, at this point. So we get to see a lot of beautiful country out here. So upholding the rule of law, ensuring that Congress fulfills its constitutional obligation. But like everywhere across the U.S., people are worried about good jobs and they're worried about the cost of living that's running rampant. So very focused on those things. And then maybe most specific to this conversation, protecting our public lands and ensuring that water stays in this district. The Colorado River runs through much of this district, and it's critically important, not just for outdoor recreation, but obviously the agricultural industry, farming and ranching, particularly with the dry winter. I know you guys are having a wet winter, but here in the western states, we've had a historically dry winter. And so there's a lot of concern come this summer that water levels will be down and we'll run real risk of bad wildfires.
Can you talk about why? Because you have had rain, but you haven't necessarily had snow. So why is a snowpack, like a strong snowpack in any mountainous region, but specifically in Colorado, really important to the health and well-being of and the livelihood of the people in that that district or where, whatever part of the country where a mountainous area and a heavy snowpack should be.
So in a typical winter, we would have in this area probably 500 plus inches of snow. And prior to having really bad wildfires in the West or places like the Palisade Fire in California, that snow would melt slowly over time into the early summer and even through midsummer. And so through the melting of that snowpack, that water would return and replenish water tables. And obviously there would also be runoff into the streams and rivers, of which then is used in the Colorado River downstream, and the water tables themselves being replenished for farming ranching through wells or the like. What's happened, though, recently with lower snowpack winters is two things. One, we just have less water that melts off and goes to the water tables and the rivers and streams. With the warmer climates in the summer, the warmer temperatures, more of the snow evaporates. So we just lose the water altogether. And the other critical thing is with wildfires, and they could be in California, they could be Nevada, Utah, with the ashes from the wildfire can spread thousands of miles. So what ends up happening is when you look at the top of the mountains that are snow covered, and as we move into the summer, you start to see brown, red, black spots on the snow from the ashes that in some cases come from thousands of miles away. And that accelerates the melting of the snow. And then a lot of that, again, just gets evaporated into the air. So we lose the water altogether.
I think that sometimes people disconnect the literal environment of an area and its impact on the people of an area. We notice that a lot when it comes to what is required in Maine for people to thrive and succeed and for the environment to thrive and succeed is unique to Maine. And it's different for every single area. And what is specific to the Third District of Colorado is unique to itself. So I'm curious about why do you feel that being not only environmentally conscious, but being like someone who is very forward with combating like environmental injustice is particularly of interest, not only to you, but to everyone in this area of Colorado?
Great question. And I think the first and easy answer to that question specific to this district is outdoor recreation writ large is the largest economic driver in this congressional district. So we don't have a lot of large companies, employers here, primarily small businesses. And a lot of those small businesses gravitate around outdoor recreation. So whether it's the ski industry, whether it's hunting, whether it's angling, rafting, or the smaller companies that produce outdoor goods, we have a lot of, in Grand Junction in particular, we have a lot of mountain bike parts manufacturers or actually the bikes themselves. So outdoor rec in this district from an economic perspective is critically important.
Zeroing in really specifically on environment here, what do you feel like the shortcomings have been of any legislation that we have seen from this administration when it comes to climate or the environment? And I mean, I think it's a fairly easy target, but I'd love to hear, you know, what you feel like we've really probably backpedaled on in a lot of ways in the last 13 months when it comes to environmental policy and just kind of like drive as a nation.
Sure. So I think let's talk about the one big, ugly, beautiful bill for a moment, because that's seeking to roll back environmental protections. And last summer, as the bill was being debated, Senator Mike Lee from Utah was championing this portion that was originally included in the bill that would have gutted our public lands. And so it did a number of different things, but the spirit of it came from the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. And it would have sold off many of our public lands. Either it would have sold them off or leased them off. And as we all know, once that begins to happen, we'll never get our public lands back. And so, thankfully, thank God, that there was a huge bipartisan uproar. And the interesting thing is that this was not just led by Democrats and progressives. It was largely led by hunters that typically lean more Republican. And there was so much pressure put on Mike Lee and the Republicans that, thankfully, this public lands issue was removed from the One Big Beautiful Bill. which obviously went on to pass. And one of the supporters of that was the guy I'm looking to unseat, Jeff Hurd. So that's the good news. The bad news is that Jeff Hurd took office as a freshman congressperson last year in January. The very first piece of legislation he proposed was called the Productive Public Lands Act. You know where it came from? It came right out of Project 2025. So notwithstanding that this stuff didn't make it into the One Big Beautiful Bill, there are other pathways that this administration and this Congress is pursuing to dismantle our public lands and not protect them. So one of the things we've made as a cornerstone of our campaign is to hold Jeff Hurd accountable and to ensure that people understand what he stands for and what he's trying to do by dismantling, you know, environmental protections as well as our public lands.
And why do you feel that our public lands need to continue to be protected and preserved? Like, why is that a cornerstone for you?
Partly from what I said, if they get sold off or they leased off, we'll never get them back, right? So it's one of the greatest assets that we have as a country. That's truly, when we say public lands, it means what it says. Like, we the public, we the people own these lands. And so for this government to try and lease it off to natural resource extraction industries for their own benefit, or, you know, whatever other path that may take, we the people lose those public lands. So one, being a champion of protecting this natural resource and asset that we have, that we the people own. And two, as I said, critically important to this district in particular, is this is the largest economic industry, the outdoor recreation that depends on the public lands for the industry itself. So it creates a lot of jobs, it creates economic activity. So critically important for me, if I were to get elected, to protect these public lands in this district in particular.
One of the things that has historically been a bipartisan aisle crosser is support of public lands. Like, historically, it's been the thing that says we can all agree that this is a really good idea to keep this, and that this is a thing that unifies all of us. I mean, it's part of the reason why making something national park status gets shoehorned into another bill, because it's going to get the support anyway. So there we go. But it isn't until I feel like this diabolical administration's second term here that suddenly it's like, oh, well, no, we're not interested in this anymore. We're not interested in protecting it, obviously, because they're only interested in protecting the money of the 1%. So it is not surprising to me that the bipartisan support came out to remove that from that bill. But the sort of persistence behind, like, let's keep tearing apart as much as we can at it, that to me is, I feel like in Congress, with where we've been before, though here we are in a situation that is deeply incongruous with where we've been before. So when we can restore, hopefully, order, flip a bunch of seats so that we can get the government back on track, do you foresee that becoming a thing where we change attitudes about universal support for public lands?
I think there is largely universal support for public lands. I think if you were to go poll the population, doesn't matter, it's a nonpartisan issue. It's just that these crony politicians are trying to, you know, I don't know if they're trying to line their pockets per se, or if they're answering to special interests who fund their campaigns to get elected. And so these are, you know, a handful of individuals that are in power that are trying to, for their own benefit, you know, roll back our public lands. But this is a very popular issue of protecting our public lands that cuts across the political spectrum and has very widespread support. And that's why it failed to make it into the One Big Beautiful Bill. The problem is, as you just noted, like, this administration just keeps pushing. So let's take like the Supreme Court's ruling on Friday of last week on tariffs and IEEPA and calling them unconstitutional. Well, what did Trump do that very day? He came out and criticized a co-equal branch of government, said that they basically were sellouts, even though he put many of those people on the Supreme Court. And then he said, you know, I'm going to impose 10% blanket tariffs. Oh, and then a couple hours later, it's going to 15%. So rather than sort of abiding by the rule of law or the will of the people or a co-equal branch of government, this government just keeps pushing. So back to, I think, the beginning of your question, first, we need to take Congress back. And by Congress, I mean not just the U.S. House of Representatives, but also the Senate, so that we can then impose, look, what Congress does is write laws, right? So we need to write clear, transparent laws that will enshrine the protection of these public lands indefinitely. And you know what? I actually am somewhat optimistic that we could get many Republicans to pass bipartisan legislation to do just that.
I love that. You mentioned right when we all jumped on this call together that you're a good friend of Mikey Sherrill, who is our governor here in New Jersey. Also, she recently hosted a campaign for you. And I do think that it is worth mentioning that you have now raised over $1 million for your campaign.
Thank you. That's right.
Which is a huge, huge accomplishment. That's a really big deal. One of the reasons I know, like, we love Mikey Sherrill, and I in particular love Mikey Sherrill, is that she is on fire to wake up and to do the work. She's on fire every day to, like, show up and do the work. And I get that same kind of energy from you too.
Thank you.
And I'm curious, like, what excites you and what sets you on fire to, like, serve in this public office in this way for Colorado's 3rd District?
Well, thanks for those kind words, and I'll take being grouped in with Mikey any day. So I agree with everything you said about her, and she's going to be a great governor of your state, and you're fortunate to have her.
She already is, yes.
Yeah, definitely. Look, most of it's driven by, as we started this podcast and this discussion, about just my history going back 130 years in the district, the fact that my family were immigrants, we're all immigrants. So to see the bullshit, excuse my French, you can bleep that out, that's going on in our country is wholly embarrassing. I know Mikey because her husband and I went to business school together over 20 years ago. We went to business school in France, actually. And so I have a very extensive international background, not just got my MBA in overseas, but I worked extensively throughout Europe and Asia and the Middle East. Both got my education there, but also had worked in those areas over many, many years. And it's just an embarrassment what's happened in this country. And it just really pisses me off. And it's the motivating factor for me to run, because I want to ensure that we get this country back on the right track. But it's also, I feel that way because of the values that were informed by my ancestors and going back, as I said, many generations in this district in particular.
Hey, y'all, it's Dusty and Mike with exciting news.
That's right. It's our episode finder. It's all about making finding our episodes even easier.
Want to find more episodes about hikes in Shenandoah? With over 10 episodes across 2 separate seasons, it would have involved a lot of scrolling and searching.
Now, with our episode finder, you can find all those episodes with a few easy clicks. That way, finding an episode on Yosemite from season 1 is just as easy as finding an episode on Zion, Yellowstone, and Haleakala, all in separate seasons.
With over 275 episodes in 35 different national parks, our episode finder will add ease when finding out more about hikes in these spaces.
But it's not just about hikes by national park. We've categorized our entire library so you can find hikes by state, hikes by terrain, and hikes by difficulty.
And all of our Trail Mix episodes are there too, so you can easily find our science-based episodes, interviews, and more.
Planning a trip to Colorado and want to hear more about our adventures there? Want to grunt it out on some really tricky trails or learn more about glaciers, grasslands, and mountains?
Just click the link in our show notes or on our Instagram bio, and it pops right up. You can also head directly to our website and look for the episode finder at the top of the navigation bar.
Conquer one hike in one national park, one park at a time, with just a few clicks with our episode finder. Happy trails!
I feel like the galvanizing factor has often been, specifically in the last few years, seeing the utter disarray, and wanting to do better, wanting to move towards a better future, and to kind of see, to borrow the fucking bullshit, and really try to make sense of all the chaos. So I think I think anyone that can use that as a springboard, as like a galvanizing force, I truly appreciate that, because I do think it takes something as horrific as what we're seeing sometimes, and I'm not saying this of you, I'm saying in general, to wake people up. And I feel like there are a lot of people within the last 13 months that have really, like, fully awakened to the crisis that we're experiencing every day. So I appreciate that as like as a jumping off point to kind of like push yourself into the race and to also, again, that idea of do better, like, and, you know, bring about a change there. One thing I think, you know, the idea of moving into a seat in the third district and becoming a congressman, what are some things that, like, specifically you would hope to try to work within the caucus to do, specifically maybe about the environment, that would really be, you know, other than kind of what we talked about, codifying the national park spaces as public lands that aren't touched ever. What are some things that you really are impassioned about when it comes to the environment and that you'd like to hopefully see legislation brought about toward?
So I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm very focused given the nature of this district, that there aren't large employers here. It's mostly small business. And that's what my family did over generations. That's also what I did to a degree in my business background. So I'm very focused on enabling small business formation, which I believe creates good jobs. And these good jobs will allow people to stay in the district, raise families, you know, hopefully fulfill the American dream. My specific background is building physical telecommunications infrastructure. So it's like construction, right? You're laying fiber optic cables, you're building cell phone towers and the like. This creates good jobs. It creates good trades and oftentimes union jobs. But not only, so my experience in building that infrastructure, I think, is equally applicable to building other critical infrastructure, which is important to allow our communities to thrive. So that could be things like our water infrastructure. You know, we've gotten away from investing in this country. We used to. The interstate highway system was built in the 1950s. And I'm glad to see that our coal plants are shutting down. There's a reason our coal plants are shutting down. It's not just because they're pollutive. It's also because they're decades and decades old and they haven't been maintained and they break down and don't operate anymore. So the coal plant here in Craig, Colorado, in the north in my district, which is one of the ones the Trump administration is trying to keep open, it's over 40 years old. It's been slated to close for the last 10 years. And even if it stays open, it's losing money, right? So that's a long-winded sort of segue to come back to saying, I know how to build physical infrastructure. We need to invest in physical infrastructure, our roads, our dams, our reservoirs, our water pipelines, our utility infrastructure, our telecommunications infrastructure. We need more housing. And I think, look, these will lower costs. They will also make our environment more resilient to things like wildfires. We need to build EV charging stations. If we have more electric vehicles on the road, you know, hopefully we can stem the climate crisis that we're literally living through right now. So I'm very focused, and my background for decades is in building this infrastructure. It will create good jobs, it will lower the cost of living, and it will help to protect our environment.
Speaking of renewables, it's fascinating to see, as a globally, we are pushing more towards renewables than natural gas and coal. But here, I feel like that has become stymied. Specifically, the Republican Party has sold out to natural gas and coal as this kind of this natural fuel source that's going to save us all. And it's not. When you take a look at the science, and this is a very anti-science administration, we know that we are continuing to barrel towards calamity. So renewables worldwide are just exploding. While they're not exploding here, they're still growing, but just I feel like there's a lid that's been placed on them by this administration. So how do we, I guess the question is, how do we get everyone on board? And that's a very lofty question, with renewables as the kind of the fuel of the future. And I think touching on sort of what you just talked about with coal plants and being pollutive and also closing because they're older and you know, how does that all enmesh together in the coming years, and maybe even in with some things you're hoping to see and achieve?
I mean, I think it comes down to two things. One's economics and one's like science, right? So on science, technology has evolved to drive down the cost of renewables. So whether that's solar panels or wind turbines or geothermal and even nuclear. So technology has evolved that's driven down these costs to make them more competitive with traditional energy sources, whether that be natural gas, coal, oil. Economically, it is insane. We have insatiable energy demand, and some of it is driven by data centers, and we could talk about that. It's something I know about, but it's also driven by EV charging stations. It's driven by home and commercial heat pumps that are electrified versus natural gas. So we do have energy demand growing, and we do need to meet that with supply, but it needs to be an all of the above solution. And this administration is curtailing some of those clean energy sources. So one of the stats I like to cite is you can begin to generate electricity start to finish from solar in 18 months. You know how long it takes to get a natural gas generator to even get it so that you can generate electricity? You can't get one till at least 2030. So economically, we have this demand. We have the ability to meet the demand through things we can put up quickly, solar in this case. The other thing that infuriates me as a business person is you have all these offshore, closer to you all on the East Coast, offshore wind farms that are like 90% complete. And the developers of those wind farms went through the regulatory process. Oftentimes, it took a decade. They got all the permits. They have billions of dollars invested. The wind farms are essentially done. And this administration comes and creates a bullshit excuse that there's a national security risk when they got the national security approvals in the first place to build those wind farms. So here they are as business people, having done everything right over a long period of time, created thousands of good paying jobs, significant economic development to develop these things. And then at the 5-yard line at the finish, they're told to stop. It's going to crush investment. It's no way to do business. It creates chaos. It's totally corrupt, totally untransparent. So all you're going to do in other industries, by the way, is say, like, we don't know what this government's going to do. We don't know what this administration's going to do. One day there's tariffs. Another day there's not. Then they're illegal. Are we going to get tariff refunds? I want to build some utility infrastructure and I'm 90% down the road and then it stopped. Like, this chaos has got to stop. I went off on a tangent there. Look, we need an all of the above solution right now, and we need a long-term energy transition to clean energy. That's not going to be 5 years. That's not going to be 10 years. I don't know if that's 20 years or 50 years, but it's going to happen.
Well, I don't think you should apologize for how impassioned you are, because we really like people who cut the shit and get to it. And so thank you. And we need more people like that working for the greater good right now. I literally text Mike today to say, like, guess what? I had to pay a tariff on a UPS package today in order to get it. It's ransomed right now, and I can't get it delivered until I pay the $30 tariff on it. For those who don't think it's like going to be at your doorstep in a matter of moments, it's already here. So you mentioned that you traveled to all of the counties inside of your district. You've put so many miles on the car. And I'm curious to know, when you met the people of your district and you met the people who live in this area of Colorado, what were some of the conversations that really stayed with you and that you feel like you're really going to take with you into the work that you're going to do for Colorado's third district?
So, yeah, I appreciate the question. Someone asked me last weekend, it was a very small town. It was actually talking about our public lands. It's a designated dark area in the country. So it's a beautiful town that sits at the base of the Sangre de Cristo mountain range, which in that particular area looks like you're in the Swiss or Austrian Alps. Beautiful, but tiny town. Woman called me on, I believe it was Tuesday, and said, hey, I know you're going to do a campaign event in an adjacent town later on Saturday afternoon. Would you consider coming to our small town of Crestone in the morning? I said, no problem, I'm happy to. I mean, that's what you do on the campaign trail. Well, she goes, okay, I'll start working the phones and let's see how many people we can turn out. And, you know, we're still a number of months out from obviously the general election. And so to get 20, 30 people is great. They turned out 60 people last minute. And a woman there said, she raised her hand to ask a question. She said, I met you over the summer and then saw you again in the fall. And then she commended me on, she's like, you've really improved your education on the issues, your thoughts, your platform. So I thanked her. And she said, kind of what you just asked me. What have you learned? What's the biggest thing you've learned in 10 months? And it truly is that this is a rural area. There are a lot of rural parts of America. You look at the center of America, you know, the flyover states, if you will. These areas are different. It's not that the people don't necessarily care about the same things, upholding the rule of law and cost of living, but I'll give you a specific example. So where does most of our food and beef come from? Well, it comes from farms and ranches, and my family was in the grocery store business. I know where groceries come from. It's not the grocery store, it's the farms and ranches. Those are in rural areas of America. And so if we want to get our food and cattle and et cetera, and have it homegrown in the U.S., they're going to be in rural areas. But you know what they also need, like everyone else? They need healthcare. They need education. But in these rural areas, it's more expensive because they're less dense areas. So when you look at a rural hospital, of which we have many in this district, Medicaid comprises roughly 60 to 80% of a rural hospital's budget. And it's just a fact of life because it's rural, right? We don't have the density to have private insurers or what have you support the 100% of the budgets of these rural hospitals. So the answer to your question is rural areas are different. And if we value as Americans cherishing what makes us different and the benefit of having these rural areas, there needs to be some distinction about how we support the rural areas versus New York City, where I lived for 20 years or grew up outside of Washington, D.C., or, you know, visited Los Angeles a lot because my twin sister was there for a decade. That's really what I've learned. And again, no surprise that outdoor recreation is the largest economic driver of this district because it is rural, it is different, it is beautiful, and we're protecting that. So if I'm lucky enough to get elected, these are the things that we have to protect because they truly are different than other parts of America.
Looking for more episodes like the one you just heard? Then be sure to check out our episode finder for episodes by park, state, hiking difficulty, and terrain, as well as all of our Trail Mix episodes in one helpful place. Click the link in the show notes of this episode, our Instagram bio, or visit our website to make your listening experience even easier.
This has been Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast, and we're here to remind you to hike early and hike often, and that adventure is always out there.
Gaze at the National Parks was created, produced, edited, and hosted by us,
Justin Dallard
and Michael Ryan.
To see images from this episode, follow our Instagram at Gaze at the National Parks. To contact us, email us at gazeatthenationalparks@gmail.com. And to find out more about the parks visited on this show, visit our website, gazeatthenationalparks.com. That's Gaze, G-A-Z-E.
All original artwork featured on Instagram and on our website is by me, Michael Ryan.
All original music was written and performed by Dave Seaman and Mariella Klinger, with Sean Sklios on guitar. Our music producer is Skylar Fortgang.
We would also like to acknowledge that while recording this episode, that we were on the traditional and stolen lands of the Lenape people, also known as New Jersey.